are back. Thank you for stopping by, ladies and gentlemen. However, you are tuning into our program. If you're joining us via the websites, redicecreations.com, rediceradio.net, or redicemembers.com. That's where you can follow us more regularly, but we are also on YouTube, Stitcher, and a number of other outlets that pick up our feed. My name is Henrik Palmgren, I'm from Sweden, and this is an independent radio program that brings you a dialogue and perspective that is beyond most of the discourse you will get elsewhere, particularly from mainstream sources. We try to look at the deeper causes behind why things are the way they are, event triggers, chronology of history, and of course how the history is written by the victors with complete disregard for the suffering of those on the other side of the story. We also address the who and the why, and look at some of the symptoms of the actions of those we are faced to deal with. Well, today we have another very interesting and important program for you. Our guest is Rebecca Roth. She enjoyed a 13-year airline career working as both a flight attendant and an international purser. She was trained as an emergency medical technician and served as a volunteer firefighter. Her expertise and training as a flight attendant allowed her to research the events of September 11th, 2001 with an insider's knowledge. And eventually this led her to discover the details and answers to some of the most haunting questions surrounding that infamous day in our history. So Rebecca is with us today to speak about her book Methodical Illusions, which is the culmination of her extensive research and personal knowledge of in-flight procedures, FAA hijacking protocols, and a lot of the other surrounding issues. Important show up ahead. Hi, Rebecca. Thank you so much for coming on with us. It's great to have you here. Hope you're doing well today.
Well, thank you. I'm doing great.
Excellent. Now, tell us first out of the gates, why did you write the book?
Well, this is an interesting story in and of itself. You know, when I had a nearly 30-year career, and while I was flying, I always had exciting things happen to me. And if there was a sports star or a movie star or somebody, you know, next thing you know, I'm out to dinner with them. So all my coworkers always encouraged me to write a book while I was flying. Well, I retired in 2004 or thereabouts. And around 2008 or 9, somewhere in there, you know, when you're retired, you don't pay that much attention. And I just kind of caught me off guard what happened. I started to write a book, and it was going to be really just a novel about flight attendants and that lifestyle and different, you know, things that happened. So all the people that I knew and met and experiences I had over those long, exciting years that I put in. And I wanted to introduce a character that was of a Middle Eastern name, a gentleman, for a date for a girl that I was a character that I had. And so I just Google searched, and lo and behold, what happened to me? I Google searched the 19 Arab hijackers from 9/11. And what popped up in front of me was a BBC article claiming that several of the hijackers were still alive. And this was dated September 23rd, 2001. Now, just so you know, after 9/11, I mean, during, I was home watching it on television unfold. During that time I was flying, I absolutely could not look into what the heck had happened and why we didn't have jets scrambled within 6 minutes. So I was in what we call cognitive dissonance. I was afraid to look any deeper. And when I found those guys were still alive and that the Saudi government was actually suing the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation over the use of not just these people's names, but their photos and their home addresses in Saudi Arabia. Well, you know, then now it's a drone strike. They do that to you. But yeah. I mean, I was like, what? I read through that article twice and it was a hammer over my head. I had never really looked in depth, but I knew something was wrong from day one. And when I was in the airline, the thing I found strange about the whole entire 9/11 event was that no one ever spoke to us about it. No one talked about how they got in the cockpit, how, what happened, all the details of those four planes. And that was something we always did, is review incidents like that in our yearly training. And so I got into a full-blown research. I went into this for a couple years, probably 20 hours a day. I was pretty crazed. Luckily, my husband came along on the trip with me.
Well, that's good. Yeah, it could be shattering relationships otherwise, right?
It is unbelievable how many people have contacted me after the book has come out and told me of their stories of how they got onto that, going down the rabbit hole, as we say, and their spouse refused to go and refused to hear it, and that it broke up so many relationships. But fortunately, my husband and I both did the research, you know, together. And what I found literally shocked me into, I was physically sick when I made the discovery of what I did and all of the information surrounding the whole 9/11 event. I often refer to myself as that guy in Close Encounters of the Third Kind that built the Devil's Tower in his house. I mean, I had charts all over my office. I had the National Transportation Safety Board data where they claimed the airplanes were descending 6 to 10,000 feet a minute, and yet we had a flight attendant sitting on the phone with no background sounds. It was everything calm, and her voice was calm, just saying goodbye to her husband and kids. And just all these anomalies popped up. And I mean, I charted them, so they didn't just totally pop up. But I thought, well, gee, that's an interesting thing for her to do. And the fact that the flight attendants and the pilots didn't follow our training, and we're very well trained. That's all we do. That's what we're there for. We're not, I know you think it's the pillow blanket and the Coke and 7-Up and the cocktails, but actually we're just trained to help you in the event of any emergency, including a hijacking. So we are the persons that are in control. And if you've ever been involved in any kind of an incident, what's decompression or a heart attack or something on board an aircraft, you will see flight attendants immediately go into that trained mode where you are trained to do that, and you don't even stop and think about it, whether you lose your landing gear on landing, the commands that are drilled into us and the step-by-step protocols for hijacking. And those were the things that I started to see were not followed by the crew. Then I started looking into the details that the passengers said, along with what the FAA and the National Transportation Safety Board were claiming the planes were doing. And I thought, nah, that can't be right. And so I really just dug into this. After I gathered all the information, I thought, okay, if I put this out there, I will be a drone strike. I mean, this is 2015, right? I actually wrote this book 2 years ago. And so when people read it, they're really amazed, because the opening scene starts out with the president of the United States being impeached over the Benghazi arms deals to actually a spinoff of Al-Qaeda from Syria. And so we are looking now. I didn't know ISIS even existed then. As I dug into who runs Al-Qaeda, I know they're not really a serious terrorist group, because they're involved with the Israeli and the United States intelligence agencies. So, I think it was kind of a interesting thing how I wrote this book, and then all of a sudden life starts imitating it. But I didn't know what to do with the information. I thought people really wouldn't be able to handle it. And so I thought, well, I'll write it in a novel, and that gives me some, you know, a little sense of plausible deniability, so to speak.
Is that why you did it in the format that you did it in?
I did, yes. Yeah. And so I invite the reader, you know, contact me through the website. A lot of the 9/11 stuff is real and it's truthful, and it is from FBI documents. And so when I discovered things like the women involved, these are on in FBI documents. Two women. At least one, but I think two, are involved, and kind of traced back a little history onto who they were through my characters. But I all of that background for those women was the FBI. And the things that I found that were really interesting and really most shocking to me as an American is the FBI was covering that up, as well as the media. I mean, I studied this stuff for thousands of hours, and I was in final edit of the first edition. The second edition is going to be coming out here in the next week or so. In my haste, there were some spelling and grammar errors that I didn't catch, and my word processor didn't. So I've got a second edition coming out where all my little mistakes have been corrected. And there's also a foreword by a United Airlines retired 767 pilot and some really great endorsements from people that are involved in the 9/11 truth movement. So that's basically the only change. And then my spelling and grammar errors have been changed. But yeah, it's kind of exciting, the things that I found. And as I woke up from my cognitive dissonance and started researching, I realized that I was a typical American or maybe a typical world citizen that was getting my information from the media. And I didn't know about a gold heist, or I didn't know that Enron, Global Crossing, and WorldCom investigations were in the Building 7 that fell down later in the afternoon after not being hit by an aircraft. And a lot of people don't even know that Building 7 fell down, or that Building 4 and Building 6 were destroyed as well.
That's right, yeah.
And so I tried to make the whole 9/11 story be presented to the person who maybe is starting to doubt and question. See, in the United States, we've got these news people now that have just been busted and caught lying and creating fake stories. And these are news presenters. They are
like Brian Williams, news, right?
Yeah. And Bill O'Reilly, the same on Fox. Yep. And already Anderson Cooper, who apparently was once with the CIA. And it's interesting, too, as I've kind of been going through some of this stuff, as I've dug in and I found how many photographers and reporters are actually with the CIA and have been for a long time. I read an interesting book called On the Trail of the Octopus by Lester Coleman. It's actually banned in the United States. You can find it on the internet in a PDF. But he basically was a DEA agent, and a DIA agent for the United States government in Cyprus. And that whole book is basically around something else I found connected to the 9/11 issue, Pan Am 103 and the heroin coming out of the Middle East.
Wow.
And so that's a great book. I mean, I highly suggest if you want to read it, I read it in one night. So if you can, you know, have yourself some nice strong coffee and read it online on your computer, you can easily do it. And it's very informative. It's interesting. And then also, he actually started out himself in intelligence work as a photographer, journalist of some sort. So it's very, very prevalent. So when you see people getting their heads cut off, supposedly, in beheadings and that sort of thing from this new group called ISIS. For some reason, we find that ISIS just absolutely will not attack Israel.
Yeah, very interesting.
They're only attacking, you know, Christians and Muslims. But they're only less than a four-hour drive from Israel. So you got to wonder. And we've certainly left them with plenty of vehicles. And they have no problem getting the gas.
Well, did you see the recent one about U.S. aid stamps were even on the they've been getting supplies, resources, weapons, ammunition, all kinds of stuff, you know, so.
Oh, yes. It's horrific. And I'm embarrassed, I have to tell you. Once I got into really the deep research on 9/11, and it just keeps on going, I'm embarrassed to be an American at this point.
Well,
My husband and I are considering leaving.
It's not your guys' fault. I mean, it's like blaming the regular English person for you know, the colonial empire, what they did or whatever. It doesn't apply. It's a kind of a misdirected sense of guilt, I think. Sure, there is a responsibility of course, trying to deal with the situation and regain control of the government. That I admit to, mm-hmm. but I don't think individual Americans should feel guilty for something that they both don't know and also has been covered up and lied about, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I don't feel as much personal guilt as I do embarrassment, I guess, on the world stage that our government is run by huge corporations, and they make money off war. And one of the things that I talk about in The Methodical Illusion, and I talk about the New World Order, and I think a lot of people don't really understand the magnitude of what happened on 9/11. And when people say to me, well, why would you write about that, such an old subject? I mean, it was 14 years ago. Well, what happened with 9/11 was such an orchestrated and methodically created an illusion as what it was. And it was so methodically created. However, The creators of the event did not, unfortunately for them, use a flight attendant as a consultant. And had they done that, they wouldn't have got caught. But how I caught them and how I discovered where the aircraft and passengers and crews were taken and how it was done and how it was covered up was by my nearly 30-year airline training and experience. And so there were things that they just didn't know. And like I said, I mean, after I discovered all this, first off, I was in shock and I couldn't even continue writing. And then I thought, well, how am I going to deliver this? And would anybody care? Well, my book has been starting now the second month at the number one position in historical fiction on Amazon in the United States. I don't know where, I haven't looked and see where it is in the UK however it's done around the other parts of the world, but I know it's selling. And I've done autographed copies to lots of countries. I probably a dozen different countries. It's amazing to me that, people are so interested in this, and they should be, because this is not just the future of the United States. The New World Order is basically the one world government that even is referenced in the Bible. It's worldwide communism and total tyranny, and we're all going to be sucked in on this. So it's really time people wake up and understand. And that really was the mission for me to write the book the way I did, was to help people understand. First off, how hard it is to wake up. My main character, the protagonist, her name is Vera Hansen. Sounds kind of Swedish, I know.
Yeah, sure does.
Vera Hansen.
Yep.
And she is a widowed flight attendant, senior flight attendant. And she had that fear of being labeled a tin hat wearer and a truther. And she refused to look after. Some time in the book, she discovers that her husband, who had been killed in an accident, was actually a pilot for 9/11 Truth and involved big in the research into the whole 9/11 event. So she makes some discoveries and she starts coming out and leaving that fear of being labeled behind. And I know in the United States, on our television, I don't know about Europe because I haven't been over there for years. But here, if you question 9/11, or if you have from day one, if you've just questioned how did Building 7 fall down, I will never forget when I started this research, listening to a news channel, CNN or Fox News, just had it on while I was, you know, cooking or something, listening to see what was going on. And someone was questioning the Building 7 falling down at 5:20 in the afternoon, having not been hit by an aircraft or any residue, really, debris from the building's towers. And they were called an anti-Semite. And I went, what? Like, wait a minute. Okay, yeah. Wait a minute. Now, okay, a building falling down. Now, how do you get anti-Semitism out of this? And I really had not looked very deep at that point. I was just starting to look at this. I just discovered the hijackers were still alive. And I thought, well, that's the strangest thing I can imagine anybody saying. But that name calling, that pinhead, tinfoil hat, truther, those kind of things. That's a Saul Alinsky response from Rules for Radical.
Yeah, yeah.
And that name calling thing is what my main character, my protagonist, was afraid of. She didn't want to look. She didn't want to look into 9/11. And I think a lot of us are like that. I think, and that's my target audience, I want people to understand that this was huge. It was complicated. There was thousands and millions of dollars in put options, stock options, insurance fraud, stolen gold, gold heist, Brady bonds that were expiring the next day worth $240 billion with a B dollars, wow. U.S. dollars. Yeah. And I mean, there were so many things. So what I did was I created a character and I wrapped up every truther I'd ever read about or seen their videos or talked to or listened to on a radio channel. And I created a character named Max Hager. And Max Hager he's a Vietnam vet, so he's a little bit older, but he's a lot wiser. And he is the truther's truther, and he delivers to the reader all of the things that went on that day so that if you got your information from the mainstream media, Max is going to wake you up to all of those things that went on. And he's got a character. Every man that reads his book wants to play him in the movie. I mean, everybody falls in love with Max Hager. He truly is the truther's truther. And so the reader actually wakes up the reader wakes up with the main character as the 9/11 truth stuff is presented to her while she's in the middle of doing other research.
Yep. Now, let me ask you, I think this is always an interesting question, because I think the biggest issue we're faced with here is not when it comes to the material that's available or you know, any of those issues. There's just so much out there, as you said, available to people. The problem we're faced with is that people, one, either refuse to look at it or just simply don't have the interest or that spark within them that causes them to ask some of these questions, which is very unfortunate. But having said that, do you think that it's easier for people? I mean, we can make the comparison of the Da Vinci Code, for example. I mean, some of the subjects that he brought up in that book, I can't tell you how many people around me started talking about those issues just because they've read it in that book, as opposed to when I talked about some of those ideas previously. So is it more of a psychologically perspective that this is much an easier way entry into these kinds of subjects, do you think, if it's fiction?
Yeah, this is really the new, the hot new way to introduce the truth to people. It's funny that you mentioned Dan Brown, because just either yesterday or the day before on Amazon, I guess your readers can go to Amazon.com and read the reviews. Somebody just on Amazon in a review compared me to Dan Brown, which, you know, was totally awesome, because I years ago studied all of the stuff that Dan Brown did on the history of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and all of that whole aspect, and back into the Knights of King Solomon's Temple and into the Illuminati and Freemason. And yes, it all does connect to the 9/11 stuff. Yes, and also Sybil Edmonds has written her latest book, is in a novel form. It is easier for people to see this. If you watched this, my book, in a movie, you would probably walk out of that movie and just like reading the book. What I've discovered are people that are coming forward to me after reading The Methodical Illusion and saying, had I read this or heard an interview of you on the radio even 6 months ago, I wouldn't have believed it. But we have been lied to. This is a war machine this country is running. We have got to stop. And how can I help? How can we get involved? And people are waking up rapidly. And if this is a tool that helps, then, you know, so be it. I mean, this thing sat for 2 years in the corner of my room in about a 2-inch thick stack of manuscript. And I'd walk by it and think, oh man, people will hate this. But that's not what happened. If people are reading it, they're waking up and they're thanking me for speaking out. And a lot of people wonder why other airline people haven't come forward. Well, they have come forward to me since the book has come out, and a lot of United and American pilots, retired, and pilots that are still working are actually buying the book direct from the publisher in quantity to hand them out. So most of them have come forward and read the book and said, you have figured this out. This is the missing piece of the puzzle. And there is no doubt exactly how I lay it out in the book, how it was done, and then how I did find who did cover it up, and how that cover-up was done, and how those companies got involved in United States national security computer systems. Mm-hmm. It's pretty frightening, because they're still in there. They just changed the name of their company.
Now, tell us more then here about what you've found when it comes to the mechanics to 9/11. We can go into the who, what, how, and, you know, maybe even why, and a certain extent. It's a big topic, of course, and you've told us some tidbits a little bit already here. But what are some of the big key elements that we need to discuss here, do you think?
Well, you know, what happened for me was I started looking, just even, let's just take Flight 11, the first plane out. And as I'm reading through these FBI transcripts, I see that one of the flight attendants used a few, coined a few phrases in the transcripts. It's typed up by the FBI. She said, she referred to the hijacker as a he, and she said this, he stood upstairs. And there are no stairs in a 767. And they're only in the 747s. And so I thought, well, that's a weird thing. Why would she say that? And then she said this. She said, we're the first. And yes, indeed, they were the first of four aircraft that day. And then she said also that he has sprayed pepper spray or mace in the business cabin and we can't breathe in business class, she's calling from her 3R jumpsuit, which is the very tail section of the double-aisled 767. It's a very large aircraft. And so she's about 155, 160 feet away from the action up there. I'm not sure how she knew what was going on. But if, let me just tell you this, my brain clicked right here. If you spray pepper spray or mace or some type of toxic tear gas type of gas like that in a pressurized cabin, everyone, including her, and she was on the phone for 27 minutes and never coughed once, never had her eyes. She never said to anybody, oh, this, you know, tear gas is so bad. It's even back here now. And it would be in a matter of about 3 minutes.
Right.
And so if the aircraft was pressurized, and that's what took me, and I said to my husband, this girl just has been waiting for a flight attendant to hear what she just said. And my ears heard it. And I guess maybe if you weren't in the airline industry and you hadn't had experience where someone sprayed cheap perfume even or broke a bottle of rum in business class, everybody on the aircraft is going to smell it in a matter of minutes. And if it's tear gas or pepper spray or mace or anything like that, it's going to be circulated through if the cabin is pressurized. And then when I saw that she said he stood upstairs, not only were they not pressurized, they were in a hangar, and every hangar has stairs. And they're usually in at least two, if not three, corners of the large hangar, depending upon which type of hangar it is and how large it is. And upstairs are always offices in a hangar. And so I realized right then and there that she put out a message that wasn't a threat to the handlers on board. There were not 19 Arab hijackers involved. I did find that 10 of them are still alive, and there are people that are much smarter than I am that are surmising that the other 9 were completely make-believe, just like I was going to do when I went to find a Middle Eastern character, and I was going to grab a first name from one and a last name from the other, which actually I did in the novel. So that is true. It's a true story. You can find out because there's two. I just grabbed a first name from one and a last name from another one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what the FBI did. And now I also found that in the first 72 hours, the FBI originally claimed that there were 4 other people that were hijackers that were part of that 19 number they are sticking to. But unfortunately, 3 of those people showed up alive. They weren't hijackers. They hadn't been in Boston, Newark, or Washington, and they weren't involved in the hijackings. And they showed up in person at their local FBI or wherever. And one of them was an FAA aviation safety employee, even.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother, who the FBI claimed was on the passenger manifest in the first 72 hours after the event, the FBI claimed that these 4 people were there. 3 of them were alive, and one of them had been dead for a year. The FAA employee's brother had actually died in a small plane crash on September 11th, 2000. And so they actually quickly backpedaled, and a lot of people don't know that's written in a book by Paul Zaremba. And I found that really interesting as well. And that came out as I continued researching after The Methodical Illusion was written, because I can't stop now. I mean, I'm digging into some details now that are just phenomenal. And I have a terabyte of information from the Freedom of Information Act to go through and just my own research and people that I believe were quote unquote handlers and were actually involved that day.
Right.
So the things that popped up for me were like the pressurized cabin, the stairs, and then also on flight 11, the 2 flight attendants were giving completely conflicting reports. One of them made a mistake that no flight attendant would ever make, ever. If your life depended upon this, you would never make this mistake. No flight attendant in the entire world would claim that a innocent passenger is the hijacker. And both of the flight attendants on flight 11 referred to only one man, singular male, as a he, as the hijacker, until later on, then Amy Sweeney cooked up with, I don't know, she used a different number, 3 or 5 or something. But originally she called in and she said the hijacker was in 9B. seated in 9B in business class. Later on, she called back and said, oh, I made a mistake. The hijacker was in 10B. 9B had been killed or had been injured and then later on killed. Well, I looked into who 9B was because I thought, well, that's a weird thing because, listen, in the event of a hijacking, what would happen is we'll land the aircraft somewhere and some SWAT team, Navy SEALs or some FBI SWAT team, police SWAT team, somebody will liberate that aircraft. And if I told them that you were the hijacker and you really weren't, you probably wouldn't live to right. to rebut my accusation. So it's not a mistake a flight attendant would make claiming that someone was a hijacker that wasn't. And so what I looked into about this passenger in 9B, I found very fascinating. He was actually a trained assassin for a foreign intelligence agency. He was also trained in anti-hijacking procedures and in hostage rescue. Those were his three specialties. He was involved in something that's called the Sayeret Mat Kol, which is a special forces unit of the Israeli Defense Forces, Mossad.
Wow.
And so we are led to believe that this man, I did a little research on him. It's really interesting because some of the stolen passports actually came from his hometown in the United States. He lived in Denver until he was 14, moved to Israel. When he was 18, he, of course, had to serve in the military, the Israeli Defense Forces, where they pulled him for the Special Operations Sayeret Matkal. I found the Sayeret Matkal very interesting because there's a couple other big players in the world stage that were also trained assassins. One of them just was at the United States Congress, Bibi Netanyahu. He's also a member of the Sayeret Matkal. And so was a gentleman who was, if you'll remember on 9/11, he was in New York City the night before, and then he was in the BBC studios. He's the man who coined the phrase war on terror and was one of the very first individuals to tell the whole world that, in fact, this was done by Osama bin Laden from a cave in Afghanistan.
Yep.
And his name is Ehud Barak. He is also Sayeret Matkal, which means that these people are trained assassins. They are trained to kill people. And so we're led to believe, now I looked up a little bit about this 9B guy that we're supposed to believe was killed. He was fluent in English, Hebrew, and Arabic. So now we're led to believe that the people sitting behind him, the two hijackers who were planning the 9/11 event, this is the biggest event since Pearl Harbor. This actually was coined to the planners who planned it. They called it the new Pearl Harbor.
Yep.
And it really, truly was. So here these two supposed hijackers are sitting in row 10A and B having a conversation right behind this guy's ears, not 2 feet behind his ears, is speaking in Arabic about their plan to take over the aircraft. He can hear them, and for no reason, they decide to jump up and stab him with a box cutter. And if you can believe that, you're still under the veil. If you can start to wake up and see what nonsense that is, this character 9B, his friends in Israel, in the IDF, they said about him he could kill any human being with a pen and a credit card. And he was a businessman traveling, and he surely had a pen and a credit card on him. And if he was listening to these Arabs planning to hijack the aircraft, then you can tell me, figure out why he didn't do something about it and allowed himself to be killed. But originally, remember, he was pointed out as by an American flight attendant on Flight 11 as the hijacker. And I believe, in fact, he was a handler, most likely.
Now, let me ask you a bit more about the flight attendants and their part in this then, if they knew what was going on. Because one thing that always comes up with me when we talk about these false flags and sting operations and people are dragged into things, sometimes knowingly, sometimes not, you know, they don't know what's going on, etc. But in this case, I'm always curious as to why allow, do you think, some of these mistakes? Were they made at the time and they were not intended to be made, but there you go, there they are? Or is there another reason for that?
Well, here's what I've had lots of people from American Airlines come forward and talk to me on the phone and through emails. And most of them knew the crew members involved, both the pilots and the flight attendants. And this is what we've came up with. Remember, on 9/11, there were several military war games going on that day with the U.S. military.
Yeah.
And we believe that what more than likely happened, there were not Arab hijackers on any of the manifests. So The real manifest, not the cooked up, made up stuff that the FBI's been lying about, but the real manifest didn't have Arab names on them. Those hijackers were not listed as passengers. So the handlers that came on, we believe, and I'll tell you in a little bit how this was, the planes were taken over remotely, what was used to do that.
Yeah.
But the aircraft were actually equipped with, well, let me just tell you that right now, because the aircraft were actually equipped with a device that was sold to some commercial carriers in the United States, not all of them, and listen carefully to how it was sold. Quote, in the event that a hijacker took over control of the cockpit, we could land the aircraft remotely, and there it would be liberated by the Army Rangers, Navy SEALs, or whoever was nearby to liberate the plane and the passengers. So now you're probably wondering, well, then if they had that on board, why didn't they use it? Because certainly on 9/11, we had four airplanes where we are led to believe that hijackers had actually taken over the cockpit, right? Well, they didn't use that because it was already in use. And when the flight termination system, or one of the airlines actually referred to it as the flight interruption system, this is very interesting because the CEO of the company that created the flight termination system, it's the same system that we run our drones around the world using this flight termination system software. And that's how we can sit in Nevada and guys can fly our drones, predator drones and that the like in Afghanistan and Pakistan and all those places where we're bombing wedding parties and elementary schools with the
right, yeah.
Yeah. And so that's how they work. And the interesting thing about that, it's created by a company called SPC, like Sam, Paul, Charlie, SPC Corporation. The CEO of that company was also the comptroller of the United States Pentagon, Rabbi Dov Zakheim. Oh. Rabbi Dov Zakheim was currently, at the time of 9/11, involved in an investigation where the Pentagon had misplaced $2.3 trillion, with a T, United States dollars. And so he's very connected to a lot of other things. What I found about this rabbi, he's a dual citizen with Israel and the United States. Somehow he managed to become the comptroller of the United States Pentagon. He also had SPC had a subsidiary company called Tri-Data. And after the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, if you'll recall, his company Tri-Data got the blueprints for both the North and South Tower.
Convenient,
so,
yeah.
Very convenient. Uh-huh. And then he also is involved with another group, a consortium of people, and they have another interesting company that refurbishes commercial 767s and turns them into military refueling tankers and sells them to military around the world.
Yeah.
So you see, without Rabbi Dov Zakheim, 9/11 probably wouldn't have happened. And so, using the
and by the way, I just want to mention, sorry to interrupt, Rebecca, but I just want to mention that if this had been any other nationality of dual citizens and what have you, this would immediately wouldn't be allowed to begin with, but it would be immediately out in the open. But it's not on this case for some reason. It's hushed up, covered up, and no one is mentioning about it. And as you said, if you bring it up, you're an anti-Semite, right? So who cares? Right?
Yes. And just much like that person who questioned Building 7 falling down. And so one of the things that I made my decision when I decided I would do interviews after the book came out and talk about what I did find is that I'm going to tell you the truth. I don't care whose religion it offends, and you can call me all the names you want because the truth is going to stand and I'm going to stand in it.
Very good.
And the truth is the only thing that'll set us free and lift the veil of lies that the media, very, very controlled media, has been covering up for over a decade. And on behalf of the flight crews that perished and the passengers on those planes and every person that died in those towers, I'm going to stand here and shout the truth from the rooftops until they take me out with a drone strike or worse.
Very good.
I have no fear of them. So let me tell you a little bit about that flight termination system, because this is really important that people understand. The flight termination system ran on a frequency much like the transponder. And so when the flight termination system took over the aircraft, and this is why a lot of the pilots in the United States, Airline Pilots Association, did not want this ever to be put on their planes. They lost all communication. It was an override system that overrided all communication, including being able to speak to the flight attendants in the cabin. Keep in mind that the cockpit door only has a little tiny peek hole, and we are their eyes and ears. If they don't hear from us, they don't think anything's going on. If the airplane is on fire in the tail section or in the cabin, they don't know about it until we phone them. So nobody wants to lose communication with their eyes and ears, and they didn't. And so only some of the airlines actually bought those. And just another interesting thing your reader or listener can look up, and readers, if you'd blog this too, is that Boeing actually got caught putting the flight termination system on a Lufthansa aircraft, maybe more than one, and also for a Chinese aircraft. They were Boeing aircraft that they took delivery of, and they discovered the flight termination system, which is basically like a plug-in device into the flight computer. And that flight computer sits between the captain and the co-pilot on the floor. So it's a very easy, I say it's about as easy as putting a USB port in your laptops. That's how easy it is. It's not something. And so they actually, when they discovered that, they sued the Boeing company, because that meant that anybody sitting in the United States could actually key in to an aircraft. And now I bet you're thinking about MH370.
Sure, yeah.
Because everyone's mind goes there, because mine did. And by the way, MH370 had just enough fuel on board to go to Diego Garcia, which is a big drone base. And these aircraft can be taken over by an AWACS aircraft, or just about anybody that's running a drone base out of Diego Garcia could have done that. The 7th Fleet was in a drill that day in the South China Sea as well. So pretty sure that's what happened. There were some people on board that had some information that somebody's government wanted, whether it was us or Israel or the UK. It's a joint drone base, actually, with the United States and Great Britain, Diego Garcia.
Yeah, yeah. Now, so, but that's a huge security risk. You talked about that, of having the ability to a termination system like that and transponders on the plane, which is, of course, would be, you'd think, dragged up into the open, and investigations would have to be made here to see that no other planes has these kinds of issues. But we've heard nothing about this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the companies that bought into it did so willingly because they were sold, you know, in the event that a hijacker took over the cockpit, we can land the plane remotely. Well, so what happens when the planes on 9/11 were taken over remotely by using the flight termination system? Since then, in 2006 or 2008, Boeing has come up with their own patent for their own device to do this, and George W. Bush made it mandatory that it's on all U.S. carriers. I don't know what's going on with the U.K. or EU or those European governments, but you could look into that in your country. Yeah. But yeah, Boeing has a new system that took the place of the flight termination system, does the same thing. And I'm being told that eventually air traffic controllers will be able to control the aircraft and land them somewhere from the actual air traffic control centers. My question was, when they said we can remotely land the aircraft, I said, who are we? Yeah. And I never got an answer to that. Well, who would we be? Because we are, you know, who are those people that could actually land the aircraft? Well, I think we figured it out on 9/11. So what we have here on 9/11, again, one of the first things that Betty Ong she's the flight attendant from Flight 11 said is, we can't call the cockpit. We can't communicate with the cockpit. And that, again, showed me that the flight termination system had taken over. When it does that, the air traffic controllers lose the transponder on radar.
Why is that?
It takes over the same frequency that the transponder uses.
Okay.
And it also, it sort of piggybacks over all communication systems. So the pilots cannot communicate with the company, the air traffic control, or other airplanes using any radio frequency that they have. So that's basically what was going on. And one of the reasons the flight attendants, including Betty Ong, who said, I don't know, but we might be being hijacked. When there's a hijacker on board, you know it. He's usually standing in the aisle, and he's usually with a flight attendant that he's got, you know, a box cutter, a knife, or a gun, or a bomb, or something. Right. And he's making a demand. Yeah. I want X, Y, and Z to happen. And so there is no doubt. And when she said, I don't know, that told me a lot. And then it told me also that it wasn't a typical hijacking. We might be being hijacked is exactly what she said. And so, again, I heard her tell me a clue that she didn't know. And if you are in a hijacking, you know about it. And there was something else that I found later on. In Betty Ong said this as well, but a lot of the callers did. They said, we're in the air. And I think that they said that because, of course, a hijacking only takes place in the air if somebody came on board when you were at the terminal on the tarmac, at the gate area, or even taxiing out and said, I want to hijack this airplane. I want blah, blah, blah. You just blow a chute and get all the people out. And so there is no hijacking on the ground. Of course, hijacking only takes place in the air. And the fact that she said that, it made me realize that a lot of the other callers were saying that too. And they were trying to convince us that they were, in fact, in the air when they were in a hangar.
And so they were knowingly saying this, and they were talking, they knew that they were,
yes,
you know, so that means, that implies, of course, that they're part of it. And then back to my original question on that, why make these mistakes along the way?
I forgot to answer your original question.
No problem.
Yes, and what we believe, and collectively, and we, the American flight attendants and pilots that have come forward, we've had some great chats about this. We believe that the handlers told the pilots and the flight attendant crew that they were part of a training drill, and that you'll notice that until you get to Flight 93, just two people were taken off each aircraft. And I believe they were removed. And when Betty Ong says there was pepper spray or mace sprayed, there was some other gas sprayed. And I think when they removed the people to make the phone calls, which was two off of each aircraft until Flight 93, they were taken to upstairs to an office, and that Betty Ong and Amy Sweeney were actually sitting in different rooms. And that's why one was saying that a doctor and a nurse were tending to 9B, who had been stabbed. And the other one was saying there was no doctor or nurse on board. And so there were so many things about those two flight attendants, because they were flight attendants and because they didn't say the most important thing that they could have said had they made a phone call. And that would have been the how somebody got into the cockpit, because that's what we would have prevented and fixed in the future. And that's how the FAA functioned. If you got in by kicking the doorknob in, then that would be the important thing for them to say. And if you got in by, using a credit card to, you know, swipe the
is that even possible?
The lock or something. There has to be a method. How did they get in? How they got into the cockpit was really the only important information, and neither one of them gave that information. They gave us that 9B was the hijacker. Then they gave us that 9B was stabbed, and then they said conflicting things. And also, they also said, Betty Ong said she was seated at the jump seat in 3R. Amy Sweeney said they were seated together in the second to the last row in coach. And so their messages were completely conflicting, which made me realize that they had been removed from the aircraft. And when they removed the two callers that were necessary to make phone calls, because without the phone calls, we wouldn't have any wars going on right now. The phone calls were the most important for the perpetrators of this event. And so the things that they said, now, I've been around for a long time. I was a flight attendant for almost 30 years and a purser. And when I flew out of places like Amsterdam, which was a big hub from Europe and the whole rest of the world into the United States.
From ship holds, right, in Amsterdam?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And we'd often have, you know, more than 60 languages being spoken. And one of the terminologies that both the passengers and the flight attendants said was they used the terminology, the hijackers were of Middle Eastern descent, and nobody talks like that.
No.
And I was like, okay, they're reading this, or they were told what to say. And so I think what happened is, to answer your question, that the aircraft were brought into these hangars at this area. The handlers picked you and you, which in this case was on flight 11, the two flight attendants, you and you, come with me. The gas that they referred to, that, you know, she never had any, neither one of them had a breathing problem in a 27-minute phone call. And being gas being sprayed in business class was one of the very first things Betty Ong reported at about 8:19, at the very first minute of her call. They took them off into two different offices where they were told to make these phone calls. And more than likely, a cyanide gas canister was thrown in and the door was shut and the people on the aircraft were killed within 3 to 4 minutes.
Hmm. So and the flight attendants possibly could have been threatened. You say yes. This, et cetera, right?
Yeah. Well, I think what they were told was it's a drill and then we want you to come and make some phone calls. They pulled them into the offices and at that point they were probably a gunshot.
Right.
They were definitely taken out. They were not part of this. I can't find any. I've got lots of people that were friends with a lot of the crew members. I can't find anybody that looks like they might have been a part of being a handler or being a part of the organization that pulled it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but we think the only reason that the pilots, because you see all eight of the pilots were highly trained fighter pilots, military pilots, and they are trained to, and what we do, when we put our uniform on, we're there for one thing, that's to keep you safe. Whether we're pilot or flight attendant, we change from being a mom and a sister and the lady next door to being a kick-ass protector of our plane and our passengers. And that's what we do. That's what we drill to do. That's what we are. And the fact that the scenarios that led later on into like Flight 93 were led to believe that the flight attendants did nothing and that they allowed a group of men, by the way, all of those men, the Let's Roll character and the other guys, they all were sitting in different rows of coach talking on the phone up until the minute they claimed the scenario goes that they were going to take over the plane by rushing the cockpit with hot water and coffee pots full of hot water. Well, let me just say this. One, no flight attendant group crew would ever give control in any emergency to untrained passengers. That's what we trained for. We had specific protocols to follow. And
somehow they would also be able to organize in this way across sitting far from each other. And so that's
exactly
ridiculous.
All of them, by the way, were on the phone up until 1 minute before this supposed rush the cockpit.
Right.
Number two, the aircraft between the captain and the co-pilot is a 2x2 about 2x2 foot square box, which is the onboard flight computer, what that flight termination system would be plugged into. Mm. And it is water sensitive, much like a laptop keyboard. And so when we would hand the captain a cup of coffee, for example, we would have to hand it off over his left shoulder and tell him it's coming in. We would just say, "Captain, your beverage is coming over your left shoulder," where he would turn around and grab it. If we put it over that computer and handed a drink or a beverage, and he turned around and hit it with an elbow, or we hit some turbulence and even a tablespoon of liquid bounced onto that computer, then it would not be a pretty picture. So it's something that all flight attendants are trained not to do. And so the fact that we are led to believe that five flight attendants on a 757 would allow four men, passengers that didn't even know each other, to rush into the cockpit, somehow break the door down and take four pots of hot water or coffee in there over that computer is nonsense. It's just complete total nonsense. So these are the kind of things that I saw.
Yeah.
And then as I got in there, and now this leads us to these companies. What happens when the flight termination system takes over? And I told you the transponder, this is how the FAA and air traffic control see the plane in the sky. They see that it's American 11. They see the altitude. They see the speed. They see all these different things on these radar screens. Well, as I dug into this, I've discovered there were two companies that were in the FAA headquarters in Washington, D.C. for 2 years leading up to 9/11. And one of them was called PTEC. And one of them was called the MITRE, M-I-T-R-E. And interesting things that I'm still discovering to this day about both of those companies. But they were able to, and what they were doing, they were actually there to make things appear and disappear on radar for the war games that were going on that day, so that FAA could not see what NORAD showed on their military jets and the NORAD military radar.
So they could simulate it. So basically what was shown to those who are looking at the screens, they think it's real. They think, oh, that this is what's going on, that they're simply reporting on what they see, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. And so that they were able to, once the flight termination system took over these four aircraft, they were able to make them, not only make them completely disappear off the screens, but they were able to replace them with a fake scenario of what they wanted you to believe those planes did after they were landed remotely. Mm-hmm. And so they have a scenario created, which they just uploaded into the computer system. And then later on, they showed you, well, these are the flight paths those planes took. And they even made animated GIF type photos of, you could see the planes moving. And they claimed that Flight 11 and Flight 175 were in a near miss, nearly a collision down by Stewart Air Force Base. But one of the things that's happened since the book came out is I've been privy to and given an external hard drive with a terabyte of FAA and NORAD information, and their official story, it does not exist on radar in text format. So those aircraft actually were not anywhere near Stewart Air Force Base at that time, they were claiming. So we're finding some really interesting things, and I'm hoping that it's enough to get the attention of some really big people. Maybe my drone strike. Actually, I'm not the only person. I'm working with a group of people, so they can't silence it by taking me out.
That's why you want to get it out, right? As much as possible.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And just blog, put it on a podcast so it can be played over and over again. And I can't keep talking.
Yeah.
But so what I discovered were these companies, and interestingly enough, that after I did the book, I still kept diving into who the handlers on board might have been. And so I'm looking into those details of those phone calls. Now tell me if we need to take a break or if
We're going to do that in a little while. Why don't you finish that story and then we'll make sure to give out some details about the book here. Yeah.
Okay. And it's very interesting because on the next flight, which also left out of Boston, there were two characters that made phone calls at 8:52. Now the flight left at 8:14. So at 8:52, interestingly enough, two people, again, just like on Flight 11, at the very exact time the calls were both made, again on Flight 175 at 8:52. And then again at 9:00, there were this gentleman, Peter Hansen. He sounds kind of Swedish too.
Yeah,
Vera Hansen's brother, Peter. That's had nothing to do with my protagonist's name, by the way. But Peter Hansen, 32-year-old gentleman, passenger, and he calls in at 8:52 and he tells his father, he calls his dad, and he tells his father that an airline hostess had been stabbed. And an airline hostess is not terminology that's ever been used in the United States to talk about a stewardess or a flight attendant, ever. It's a European term, and it's a Middle Eastern term. El Al calls their flight attendants airline hostess. Some Asian companies do. I mean, remember being in Japan and China and being referred to as an airline hostess by a Japanese girl. But it's not an American terminology. We were stewardesses until 1968. And then we became flight attendants because we started hiring so many males in that position. So this guy is, by the way, he is American. He's 32. So his entire lifetime, we have been referred to as a stewardess or a flight attendant. So that was another key that I thought that he either was told to say that or was reading off a card to say that. Because it's not terminology that is normally used by an American. But he tells his father at 8:52 that he thinks the hijackers are going to fly them to Chicago, where they will be flown into a building. And prior to 9/11, unless you'd been told the scenario before that phone call, you would never have dreamed that scenario. Then again, he calls his father back at 9:00, exactly 3 minutes before impact, to the South Tower in Manhattan. So 3 minutes before that plane went in, you would know you were over New York City. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he tells his dad now, this time the stewardess has been killed and stabbed, and that uses the word stewardess. And then he says that they've used pepper spray or mace and that people around him are vomiting and getting sick.
Huh.
And so I thought, well, that's really interesting because you don't really get sick and vomit from pepper spray or mace, but you do from hydrogen cyanide. So that kind of told me something. And now on that same call, there was another gentleman that at first I overlooked this totally. But it's interesting that he calls his mother, first his wife, leaves a call message on her home recorder, then calls his mom at 9 o'clock. This is 3 minutes before impact. Now, keep in mind, New York City is something like 365 square miles. It's huge. So when you're over Manhattan or over New York City, you know where you're at because you're, you know, it flows into Newark and all of these. It's just huge. And so if you were a pilot, this guy was an F-14 pilot, which is why I at first overlooked him as being a handler. But he tells his mother at 9 o'clock, 3 minutes before impact, that they're over Ohio, he thinks. Now, he's a pilot, so he should be able to tell Manhattan from rural Ohio. And 3 minutes before impact, he would definitely be seeing buildings in New York. So then he also tells his mother that they are thinking, this is now 8 minutes after supposedly the hijacking took place, the passengers, are thinking about taking over the cockpit. And that's the scenario from Flight 93 with the hot water. And then I realized that this guy, he also had been told of the scenario. We have Betty Ong saying, we're the first, and she was on the first plane. Then we have Peter Hansen and Brian Sweeney from Flight 175 saying they're going to fly us into a buildings in Chicago, and then we're going to take over the cockpit. And then I realized right then and there that some of these people had definitely been told the entire day scenario, which leads me to answer your question. The people that made these phone calls were told, and the passengers and crew were told they were part of a drill and this was the scenario, and they laid it out for them, and that's the only way they knew those details. However, as I kept digging into Brian Sweeney, his friends in Miramar, Top Gun, he's a Top Gun fighter pilot, F-14 fighter pilot, all of his friends, much like 9B, all of his friends said he was 6'2", 225 pounds. He could kill any human being with his bare hands. Why he didn't is the question of the day. As I was researching him after my book came out, I actually was in his online obituaries in about, as I'm reading through this, a 15 or so obituary comments that people made to him, to his obituary, said, I remember you, Brian, from the M cafeteria in the months preceding 9/11 when we worked for the MITRE company, which is one of the companies that we just talked about that was able to make things appear and disappear on radar. And that is basically the shadow government of the United States. And I would venture to say they're in control of most of the world.
Well, it's a huge story here, of course, very important, and I have just so many more questions for you, Rebecca, but I want to make sure, of course, first here that we give that you give us the story first and explain to our audience so they know what you've found. And, of course, we're going to pick this up here in a little bit. We'll take a break shortly here and just continue on the story, and I'll ask more questions for you then as well. But before we take a short break here, let's just give out the details here about the book, of course, for people who want to read more and follow along in this very interesting, well, it's a historical fiction, but again, it's based on what Rebecca really has found. It's called Methodical Illusions. And give us the details on the website, Rebecca, so people know where to go to pick up a copy and read more.
I sure will. The website is simply www.methodicalillusion.com. And there you can do a look inside and read the first almost 3 chapters of the book. You can purchase it on Amazon or through any bookstore that can order a book for you. It's in the Ingram list, so it takes about 5 to 7 days to order it. If you have a local bookstore you like to visit, it's available on Amazon and in softback. And it's around $15 to $16 for that. And then it's also on a Kindle form. And if you go in and go to buy the Kindle, we'll be uploading the second edition shortly. And so if you go and it's not available on Kindle, just give it 24 or 48 hours here, because it will be. I'm just going to put the second edition in, and it just is going to be offline for just a short period of time for the Kindle. The Kindle is $9.11 in the U.S. So don't know how that breaks down in the U.K. and the E.U. It's available that way. If you're interested in autographed copies, you can get one for $20 US, $30 for international orders, and you can order that fill out the form or send me an email with your payment and shipping information, and I'll sign you a copy and send it to you. And we just had to charge a little bit more for the international postage. Sorry about that. But that's $20 US US books and $30 US dollars for all international orders, autographed copies. And you can just do that off the website. And I'm available to answer any questions. If you read the book and you want to know, do I have documents to prove this or that, or what's real or what's not, I welcome your questions, and will help you proceed in your wake up if you're just having that veil lifted. The thing that I found that's interesting about 9/11, since I was in cognitive dissonance like a lot of people are, and I didn't want to look at it, but once I did, once the veil of 9/11 truth is lifted, you begin to see things like what we just saw happen in Copenhagen and in Paris with the Charlie Hebdo event, and you'll start to see things that are the same type of things. Like on 9/11, we had two passports survive, but nothing else. No luggage, no landing gear, no hydraulics, nothing of the aircraft, but a passport from a hijacker, not from any other passenger, but just the hijacker. And then after the towers, there was one of their passports survived as well, in pretty darn good condition. So you'll see in Charlie Hebdo, they also left the driver's license behind in one of the carjacked stolen cars. Mm-hmm. So you'll see the same type of details, so that we know who to hate. And that's why the phone calls had to be made on 9/11. They needed to paint the picture of Middle Eastern, so that we could go and fight in all those wars that they had planned when they planned and wrote the project for the new American century, which actually called for a new Pearl Harbor event to get the American people on board to go do these seven or more wars in the Middle East.
Very good. We'll talk more about that here in the second shortly, of course. Methodical Illusion. I added an S on that earlier. Sorry about that. It's Methodical Illusion, and the website is the same, methodicalillusion.com. We'll have that linked up, and of course, check out Amazon.com links as well. We'll have those on the website. But yeah, we'll take a short break here. Stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Rebecca. We'll be right back. In the Members Hour, we look at the psychological warfare and brainwashing techniques used in creating a Hegelian dialectic, along with the conspired solutions to big problems that fatten the wallets of insider corporations. Rebecca gives details of the shadow government in control of everything from radar to national security, the IRS, and the healthcare industry. Later, Rebecca tells us how she pieced together the parts of the disappearing planes and the manipulated illusions that were created to explain away the impossible crashes. At the end, we discuss media spokespeople with ties to Zionist circles, the funding behind technology, and Israeli intelligence that makes the New World Order plans possible, and the worldwide plan for total control that could soon come together in a giant crescendo. Please join us for much more at redeyesmembers.com. Support an independent radio program that brings you exciting, important, and vital information and research on many of the forbidden topics that you are not supposed to learn more about. Sign up, get full access, stream, or download any of our programs going back to 2006. Almost 1,000 shows on a lot of different topics. Also, before we proceed, some of our upcoming guests, Joshua Blakeney, E. Michael Jones, Marion Van Court, and also Vasily Lupash and Alexander Dugin. Very interesting shows ahead here. But we'll pick this up right after the break. RedEyesMembers.com. Join us there. Thank you so much for listening.